The Brief is supported by Bloomberg Connects, the free arts and culture app. Spring budget criticised for failing to boost housing. A government report finds low traffic neighbourhoods are popular and effective. Grimshaw unveils major new redevelopment plans for Waterloo Station. And how simply partying more could help our struggling nighttime economy. My name is Merlin Fulcher. I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's big stories in architecture, planning, and housing news. Welcome to The Brief from Open City. My guest this week is Simon Vickery. Simon is Programme Manager of the Open House Festival. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Merlin. Thanks for having me.
Last week's spring budget was criticised for not addressing the nation's wider housing problems. With the Chancellor's pledge of £118 million towards a life science hub and 750 new homes at London's prestigious Canary Wharf district raising some eyebrows. Jeremy Hunt announced funding for the 40-hectare East London Docklands estate alongside £124 million to unlock 7,200 homes at the Lifshitz Davidson Sanderlands masterplanned Barking Riverside and £4 million to set up the Euston Housing Delivery Group to drive forward plans for up to 10,000 new homes. But, as reported by the AJ, industry leaders have hit out at a perceived failure to unblock key issues holding the UK back from delivering many more thousands of much-needed homes. Pocket Living founder and chief executive Mark Blessing said, quote, "The rapidly emerging consensus is that we need to deliver 500,000 new homes per year, yet we can barely manage 200,000 at present. We need action to save a small and medium enterprise house building sector in crisis, yet despite intense campaigning by the sector, we haven't received a penny of support in this budget," end quote. He added that the Chancellor had missed the government's last chance to, quote, "unlock 1.6 million homes on brownfield sites through a fairer and faster planning system," end quote. Meanwhile, beyond central government, millions are bracing for soaring council tax bills as local authorities desperately try to balance the books by raising taxes as high as they can. According to reports in The Big Issue, millions of households will get poorer from the 1st of April, as bankrupt towns and cities are expected to raise bills by hundreds of pounds. 75% of councils across England and Wales are expected to raise taxes by the maximum 4.99%. However, many local authorities have been given government permission to go beyond this, with Birmingham residents expecting a 21% tax hike, making them £840 worse off over 2 years. Okay, firstly, Simon, with the country suffering from a major shortage of good quality affordable housing, why has the latest spring budget failed to impress experts when it comes to boosting housing? And why is this decision to invest significantly in levelling up Canary Wharf catching so much attention?
Well, simply, it's unimpressive because it has nothing to say about the housing crisis. It features no acknowledgement of the housing crisis at all, actually. There's nothing to speed up the planning process, no investment in the wider house building sector. The broad consensus now is that in order to tackle the housing crisis, which sort of includes within it crises of quality, supply and affordability, we need to be building more homes in priority areas, and that doing so will help to tackle each of these elements of the crisis to some extent. The government did announce plans to invest in skills and education programmes to attract more people to take up roles as local planners, which is great. This is actually a little bit more long-sighted, but it will take time for us to see the impact of this. There's no resourcing for the planning system right now, and that in particular feels like a missed opportunity. And there's more missed opportunities around the lack of green investment in our housing stock. Campaigners called for a wide-ranging retrofit scheme to help tackle the issue of poor quality housing stock, rising energy bills, the challenges of climate change, and an economy in recession. There's none of that. A properly resourced scheme would create jobs. It would help to reduce energy bills. It would improve people's living conditions. And it would also help the government hit its carbon reduction targets, which increasingly it looks like it's going to sort of fall wildly short of. In general, there was no acknowledgement that people in this country are living through multiple crises. Hunt actually had this upbeat tone that was wildly at odds with most people's lived experience. Keir Starmer actually said something to this effect in Parliament, although since the budget, it's not clear that Labour would do anything other than pay lip service to these crises themselves. I think the levelling up of Canary Wharf that you mentioned is of particular interest and significance because it does signal this complete abandonment of Johnsonism. Levelling up through investment was one of Johnson's, or maybe Johnson's, key pitch to the deindustrialised former Labour heartlands in 2019, mainly in the north of England, what sort of has ended up being called the Red Wall. With Sunak and Hunt, we've seen the return to austerity politics of Cameron Osborne, even if that's not quite how they pitch their project. This budget suggests that they really are committed to abandoning the Red Wall voters, but there's an anxiety about shoring up their traditional base of big business, which is why we see this levelling up rhetoric applied to a central London business district. So I kind of feel with this, like the mask has slipped and we're back to the Tories of previous parliaments.
But I'm just thinking, like, okay, so imagine if someone from government was here, they might push back and say, hey, we've been talking about promoting housing for decades now. We've had a whole range of initiatives. And if you look at the latest budget, we're putting money into new homes in Barking Riverside. We're putting money into new homes in Canary Wharf as well. Is that not enough for you?
Well, no, it isn't enough. Not for the scale of the problem. I've forgotten the name of the guy you quoted from Pocket London, but he'd said
Mark Blessing.
He said 500,000 new homes for new people. I mean, that is really ambitious, and that tells you something about the scale of the problem. So, as much as we might welcome investment in an area like Barking, it's a sticking plaster compared to the scale of the problem.
If we think about this financial crisis, which is facing councils right now, certainly reaching fever pitch in the media, we're hearing that more than half of council leaders in England are warning their authorities are likely to go bust within the next parliament. It sounds a pretty catastrophic thing that we're going to have to witness over the next few years. Meanwhile, SNP, that's the Scottish National Party's finance secretary, Shona Robinson, they've meanwhile warned that poorer families are going to be disproportionately affected by the anticipated tax hikes. Simon, how have we got into this dire situation? Has a lack of central government funding played any part in this crisis?
Well, the short answer is yes. There have been significant reductions in central government funding for local authorities since 2010. There's been real terms cuts in spending of over 40% on many essential services. This then creates a vicious circle where councils have to look for money elsewhere, such as through raising council tax and business rates. Council tax it's one of the more aggressive taxes. It really kind of hits poorer people much harder than it does wealthier middle-class people. Likewise, with business rates, it can have a real impact on smaller businesses that might already be struggling, so they don't want to see those rates rising at a time like this. Councils also look to slash services like transport and planning, but often more crucially, they make cuts to services like adult and child social care, to housing and homelessness as well. So people are seeing an even more pronounced decline in the services that they rely on at a time when, due to increases in the cost of living, they need these services even more than ever. For some councils, that crisis was deepened by a practice of borrowing money from central government to build commercially, as a practice that was discontinued in 2020, but did mean that many ran up unaffordable debts when schemes ran into problems. The example of Birmingham shows that individual councils do face unique crises. So in this case, they had the £1 billion settlement of equal pay claims and issues with their £100 million IT system. But they're more vulnerable because of lack of central government funding. So there will be these exceptional cases, but a lack of funding has sort of created the conditions for these exceptional cases to be really sort of critical for individual councils.
There are some people who might say, well, you know, a local authority, it's like a business, it's like a household budget. You've got a responsibility to look after that yourself. Is it not fair to say that this is local authorities' fault?
Sure. I mean, there's an onus on councils to future-proof themselves, but they're not being given the opportunity to do that through making proper public investments that would allow them to actually collect revenue on a large scale, something like social housing. So they have to resort to making increases in council tax that are then going to put pressure on their existing services. So the kind of revenue streams that are open to them often come back to bite them. So without that kind of significant funding from central government, they're not actually able to engage in that kind of long-term planning.
The South London Borough of Southwark has asked its residents to invest their own money to help fund green projects such as cycle lanes, LED street lighting and leisure centre upgrades. So under the scheme, the council aims to raise around £1 million with the offer of a 4.6% return for its investors. Simon, what do you think of this? I mean, are we returning to like a kind of historic approach to philanthropy here? And do you think this funding of public projects is a practical solution to that financial crisis you just outlined? Or could this risk a whole new set of problems?
Well, I did see that the minimum investment is a fiver, so it doesn't quite feel like the golden age of Victorian philanthropy. But I think in some sense it's quite a creative solution. Obviously, green projects are key. You know, we can't do without them. I can see why councils are looking to make creative solutions, but I do think it's terrible they have to resort to this. So the council suggests that it's through this scheme they're engaging people in the council's climate emergency plans. Sure, but giving some money isn't meaningful participation. It'd be better to actually find ways to include people in decision making. And I think a key thing to remember is that people do actually already contribute money to this. It's called tax. The idea that you should pay your tax and then have to support local projects in addition out of your own pocket is dangerous because it starts to really erode the idea that services are something provided by national and local government. So I suppose in that sense, it is quite Victorian.
Yeah, certainly it feels a bit like the startupification of like local government, the way it's like, hey, I've got this plucky financier idea and like we can do this. And well, actually other local authorities have done this as well. Westminster's one, etc. But say if I don't live in Southwark, but if I was to go for this scheme, you know, and my money doesn't come back, I'd have a personal annoyance with Southwark Council. I'd say, you know, as an investor, I'm going to think twice about you. And I think that's a really weird relationship to have with local government.
Yeah, I agree. That is a really dangerous road to go down. It stops something from being a public service and starts to be, something that's the object of charity. And, you know, with essential green projects, we don't want them to be things that exist because people have a bit of spare cash to throw at them. It needs to be something that's properly and centrally funded.
So just looking at the bigger picture with the budget, it's been criticised for basically being short-termist. Simon, why do you think we've become stuck in this kind of short-term mindset where it's rare for major financial statements, such as a budget, to really capture the public imagination in the way they once did?
The short-termism partly comes from the fact that Conservatives have a set of fiscal rules that structure their economic policy.
Which they would say are long-term.
Well, so one of these rules is that they should shrink national debt as a proportion of GDP over a five-year period. So which basically means it needs to be falling between years 4 and 5. And then the difference between those 2 years is what you have to spend. And that's what gets called sort of fiscal headroom. And as anyone who's ever seen me use a spreadsheet, I'm like definitely not an economist, but like that's my understanding of how it works. Labour have signed up to that too. But the problem with this commitment with structuring your kind of policy in this way is that it only ever gives you a small amount of money to spend. It's sort of tens of billions at a time. So for context, the total health budget for the financial year that's about to end now, 23-24, was 168.2 billion. So tens of billions across an entire economy really is small fry. And also it's subject to frequent change because it's a projection. So 5 years, it's actually sort of too far in the future to allow for any sort of long-term stability because it's volatile. As projections and predictions change, it means you're having to constantly change your spending plans. That naturally mitigates against long-term planning. Any economy needs long-term planning, but especially in a time of multiple crises. And our current challenges, from the housing crisis to the climate crisis, do require public investment over a protracted period. But both parties at the moment seem allergic to that. Tories, because they're sort of ideologically opposed to public spending, and Labour, it seems, because they're still burnt by being presented as fiscally irresponsible following the 2008 crash. And they're really sort of scared, in particular, of the right-wing press and how they'll be sort of presented in that. If neither parties are interested in investing, then neither have a plan to meet the current moment. So tinkering around the edges and short-termism are all that ends up being available to you. I think this question of whether it's skewed people's sense of what government and society more broadly can do to enact real change is a really interesting one. So I was looking at some kind of recent public opinion surveys. So there's one by Ipsos last year that said 75% of Britons disagreed that in the long term, the government's policies would improve the state of Britain's public services.
Gosh, that's a lot.
It's depressing, isn't it? But at the same time, that survey found that a majority are opposed to policies that cut spending on public services. And then in 2022, a poll by Servation found that over 65% of people support public ownership of water, of energy, rail, buses and Royal Mail. So people do still believe that there are solutions to these problems and that they could be implemented at a sort of national level by government. It's just that no one from the main parties is offering that.
I mean, the people who write these budgets, they'd say in defence that, look, this is what it takes to maintain financial credibility on the global stage. They would say, look what happened, you know, in the Liz Truss budget, for example, saw a crash in the value of the pound. I know that wasn't public spending, but it was a different kind of uncosted spending. And they would say, yeah, this is just the nature of the thing. Yeah, what's the alternative?
The current consensus is that being in debt as a government, as a country, is a bad thing. But that has not always been political consensus in government, and it's certainly not political consensus outside of government. The problem when you have two major parties that agree with one another is there's no space to have that conversation. There's no space to be sort of genuinely critical in the sort of public political realm of this approach.
The government's official study of low-traffic neighbourhoods, commissioned by Rishi Sunak amid efforts to prevent LTNs being built, has instead concluded the schemes are both popular and effective. This is according to an initially buried report, which was picked up by The Guardian. The Department for Transport review was ordered by the Prime Minister last July, as the LTN culture war peaked with the Prime Minister capitalising on the controversy by assuring motorists he was, quote, on their side. Low-traffic neighbourhoods, largely installed by Labour-run councils across the capital, divided politicians this year, and Downing Street had hoped that this long-delayed review would back up arguments against LTNs. However, the findings largely point the other way. A copy of the as-yet unpublished report, which was seen by The Guardian, said twice as many local people supported LTNs as opposed them across the four sample neighbourhoods the DfT polled. The report also found that though formal studies into their effectiveness were limited, they did not support the argument made by opponents of LTNs that instead of easing overall congestion, they simply displace traffic onto nearby streets. The report read, quote, "The available evidence from the UK indicates that LTNs are effective in achieving outcomes of reducing traffic volumes within their zones, while adverse impacts on boundary roads appear to be limited," end quote. Initially due to be released for publication in January 2024, the government has been accused of trying to bury this report as its findings go against the government's own plan for drivers, outlined in September, which promised a clampdown on LTNs, bus lanes and 20-mile-per-hour speed limits, along with moves to prevent councils from fining people for infractions. Meanwhile, the London Mayor Sadiq Khan has hailed the, quote, "remarkable progress" on air quality in the capital as a new GLA report found roadside pollutants were falling faster than elsewhere in the UK. Nitrogen dioxide levels fell by 49% between 2016 and 2023, while last year levels are even lower than the 2020 lockdowns when less people were on the roads. Okay, so Simon, the past year has seen traffic control measures such as LTNs and 15-minute cities ignite another culture war front. They've even been at the focus of some conspiracy theories. What's your experience of LTNs as a South East Londoner, and why are they causing such a furore?
So at the start, I should probably out myself as a car owner. I've only got a car recently, and while I don't drive short distances, I'm not honestly sure whether that's just down to my green credentials or whether the LTNs are really sort of changing my behaviour. I do have a set of perceptions about what their negative impacts have been on the area, and that's why I was really interested in the this unpublished study. That report would suggest that my perceptions are wrong. My feeling is that it's undoubtedly nicer for people who live on the streets where the measures are in place, but these are more likely to be middle-class people. They're already living further away from main roads. So perhaps they're sort of less in need of these measures. They certainly have made local journeys harder, so it's a definite deterrent for shorter journeys by car. But my sense is that it's also really increased congestion on already busy roads. It makes the experience of being a pedestrian on these roads more unpleasant. Often those main roads are residential as well as commercial, and the people who live there are more likely to be working class residents already living with bad air quality that's just sort of getting worse as congestion gets worse. And I do feel like they've made, or my perception is at least they have made, longer car journeys more difficult too by increasing overall congestion, which is why I was really interested to read that line in the report that didn't support the contention that the LTNs have simply displaced traffic. So is the sense that they've increased congestion on the main roads just plain wrong? I guess the gap between evidence and public perception does make sense. If you used to be able to drive down a side street and now you have to drive down a main road, then you're experiencing a more congested journey as a result of an LTN. So I guess maybe the challenge then, if we think LTNs are a good thing, we need to think about how to take people sort of with you on that journey. I didn't mean that to be a transport pun, but there we go. by bringing sort of services and amenities closer to them. At the moment, it's all sort of stick. So it's like making it difficult to drive small distances. But, you know, we need some carrot as well. So making it so that people don't need to make those short journeys in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely a kind of a communicational leap that's necessary with really complicated, brave political decisions. Advocates of LTNs would say, if you look at this scientifically, there are only so many journeys taking place, and this is about a modal shift. So we know there's a big chunk of journeys which are kind of enabled by the ability to shortcut through beautiful little residential streets to like trim a few minutes off. If you can bring about a modal shift in the short term, that might bring some upheaval. There might be some bigger queues on those major roads. And then the bigger picture is that it then opens up a space for those like pedestrian journeys, cycle journeys to replace those carbon intensive car enabled journeys. What do you think of that?
So you talked about this kind of modal shift that over time people will gradually move to stop making these unnecessary journeys. But that does assume that actually it's possible to get to local amenities in a few minutes walk. And for lots of bits of London, so I live in Lewisham, I live right in the centre of the borough. North of me, it's a very kind of inner London area, very networked, lots of amenities, lots of high streets. South of the borough, really quickly gets suburban, really spread out, transport is really dispersed. Lots and lots of rows of terraced houses. High streets are very few and far between. So actually, if you live in an area of London like that, it's not that easy to just swap the car for walking instead.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating point to make. London obviously has these massive divisions between inner and outer London when it comes to transport provision. And those sort of threshold places is where it's very evident. Now, this report found that 58% of people surveyed didn't even know they lived in an LTN. So, Simon, is this evidence that the controversy and polarisation around the schemes is largely generated and fueled by politicians, by irresponsible media, potentially? And also, why has this issue become such a big sticking point in Parliament?
I think absolutely. This was one of the most interesting bits of that article. I think it's a huge sort of concoction of politicians and the media, which is not to say there aren't genuine concerns or even interests in these schemes, but the way it's been blown up has been really out of all proportion. Like you say, it's sort of part of these culture wars, which are a way to engage your voter base without having to make them a material offer, such as improved public services. It's a way to energise them to go out and vote for you, despite the fact that you've been in government while they've been getting poorer, sicker and colder. While they've had less opportunities. I do think, interestingly, there's a grain of truth in anxiety around the LTNs, ULEZ and 15-minute cities. I think with all conspiracy theories, it's really instructive to look at, well, what's the grain of truth? What's the kind of lived experience that is making people kind of buy into these narratives? So like I've said, if you're living in an area of London like the south of Lewisham Borough, suburban bad transport links, high streets few and far between, then you do rely on your car and your experience might be that your travel is getting harder. So if someone tells you someone in a position of power is trying to keep you in your area, that might chime with your experience. So I think, as you've sort of indicated already, you can't win this argument rhetorically, or not just rhetorically. You have to actually implement policies that would change people's experience of living in their area.
Turning to air quality, so there's a new GLA report which indicates some remarkable progress. The ULEZ expansion, which was strongly opposed by both central government and even the Labour leader Keir Starmer, seems to have been a significant contributing factor in reducing this air pollution. What does this tell us about the effectiveness of schemes like ULEZ and also LTNs in tackling the issue of air pollution? And how does this differ from narratives which are being told by some?
I think it tells us that the schemes work and that when they're opposed by politicians, they're opposed for political, not practical reasons. Traffic reduction measures are often implemented by Labour-run councils. So it's an easy opportunity for the Tories to attack Labour on these policies. Tories did this with some success, well, considerable success in the Uxbridge and South Ryde slip by-election last year, which did seem to be won largely by the Tories' opposition to EULAs. But as you also said earlier, they've come out against bus lanes and 20-mile-per-hour speed limits, as well as other plans that support active travel. So I think these really are unserious, cynical and deeply regressive political positions.
A Grimshaw-led team has unveiled its master plan for redeveloping London's Waterloo Station. This was reported in the AJ this week. The London Waterloo Station vision sets out a series of long-term aspirations, including a redesigned northern concourse, that's the current concourse, a new subterranean southern concourse, which will go underneath the platforms, and also more than 40 new walking and cycling routes connecting the station to other parts of the capital. The plans for the clients Network Rail and Lambeth Council also include new public spaces, workspace, and an enhanced bus and taxi interchange. Grimshaw Architects, which famously worked on the Waterloo International Terminal, built in 1993 for the Eurostar, they landed the contract for the master plan in September 2022. And they've since been working with Beaudelet Design Studio, WSP, Exterior Architecture, Hatch, Savills, Turner & Townsend and Iceni. It was tasked with helping to, quote, realise Waterloo's full potential as a connected, safe and thriving net zero neighbourhood with an integrated world-class station at its heart. End quote. So the work needed to deliver the plans is currently not funded. Lambeth Council and Network Rail said they will work to refine and develop the plans, and the local authority is investing £1.5 million in delivering some of the smaller public realm improvements contained within. Grimshaw partner Kirsten Lees said the master plan was designed to help Waterloo reach its full potential through a visionary and aspirational framework that's pragmatic and can be delivered through a phased approach. Seems pretty reasonable. So, Simon, what do you make of Waterloo Station as it is now? And do you think this revamp will bring much needed improvement?
So I don't often go through Waterloo at rush hour, which tends to be the best test of how well a major station is working. But I have always found that that main concourse is nice and straightforward. Big timetable, majority of the platforms directly in front of you. There's a real sort of clarity to that space, and there's something sort of nicely classical about it. It kind of feels like a proper train station. I think maybe the more interesting opportunity is the public realm around the station, but I think there's some potential pitfalls here as well. I think pedestrianising that area outside the north entrance is really welcome. That sort of more War Memorial entrance, kind of out the front there, sort of near the roundabout with the IMAX cinema. In the centre of it, so there's lots of traffic. You always get sort of taxis kind of whizzing down from that road that runs past the station. So making that kind of much more pedestrian friendly, I think, would be really welcome. There's the recent development of Lower Marsh and its connection through to Leake Street. It's really helped to sort of open up that area. It previously felt a bit Warren-like. So creating further connections for pedestrians there just does feel like it could be really positive. But I think the danger is that there's real sort of character to that area around the station, and it would be a shame to sort of lose that and to sanitize it. So the Vault Festival was sort of running there for several years and really quickly became a real sort of feature of London's cultural calendar, is a really cool venue to be in. The plan suggests that the Vault's theatre, even if not the sort of festival, so the building itself, will be retained, as will Leake Street, which is the sort of legal graffiti wall that kind of runs down the side of the station at the moment. But I sort of can't really see it retaining its character if the arches are sort of opened up and incorporated into this lower southern concourse. And so that would be my concern.
So we have a habit of often thinking of infrastructure as purely functional, but clearly, as we see with Waterloo, there can be beauty in infrastructure and also scope for great design. Simon, are there any infrastructure hubs you'd love to get into for the Open House Festival?
So the first one's a slight cheat because I actually did go in there last year. I just really hope it will be in again. It was E.ON's CityGen Energy Centre, which is right opposite the old Smithfield Market. It's an incredible building. So the facade, I think it was the cold part of it, was the cold store, sort of giant 19th century fridge for meat at Smithfield's.
Is this next to Fabric?
Yes. Part of it's 19th century, part of it's 1920s, and then you go in and there's this real power station, essentially, right in the centre of London. And through its ground source heat pumps, it's going to serve the new London Museum, it's serving the Barbican, it's serving other kind of office blocks. So big kind of new and existing developments in the local area kind of being served by this energy hub. So it was a real insight into what kind of locally produced energy solutions could look like for London. So I really hope that's in again. And one of the Crossrail stations, as a bit of a London transport nerd, I would love any of those in. I'd really like to see behind the scenes at Farringdon. And we do talk to TfL every year, and they always make a really amazing contribution to the festival. So let's hope they come up with the goods.
A new report paints a dire picture of the future of nightclubs in the UK. But the power to change that is in our hands, according to an opinion piece in The Guardian by the journalist and co-host of the Cursed Objects podcast, Dan Hancocks. The nighttime economy is worth an estimated £66 billion in the UK, and a recent report from the Nighttime Industries Association, that's the NDIA, looked into the economic and cultural impact of electronic music and found that it is thriving on digital platforms at festivals and on the global stage. However, it found that the bricks and mortar world of clubbing is in a deepening crisis, with nearly 400 venues lost since March 2020, a fall of a third compared to the pre-pandemic total of nearly 1,300 nightclubs. Hancocks noted that specific venues are more at risk than others, with Black and Latin-owned venues and venues outside major cities being at a heightened risk of closure. Concern over nightclub closures has sparked a flurry of panicked articles mourning the death of nightlife, with a recent Daily Mail headline claiming the, quote, annihilation of London's party scene, and another Dazed article declaring that, quote, UK clubs will be extinct by 2030. Hancocks, however, takes a more optimistic look at the scene, praising the success of some grassroots venues, including Ormside Projects, Venue MOT, and The Carpet Shop, all local to South East London. And the answer, he says, to securing their future is simply to engage. He writes, quote, don't mourn, rave. Rave and get involved in the specific challenges in your local area. There are almost always small independent venues under threat that are desperate for public support, in need of advocates in battles with landlords, developers, NIMBY residents, and local authority hearings and public consultations. Whether or not you consider your dance floor days to be in the past, I would encourage everyone to join in the demand. Give us bread, give us bangers too. End quote. So Simon, are you a raver or former raver? And if so, what are some of your favourite venues, both now and in the past?
I think, although it pains me to say it, I think I'm firmly in the category of former raver these days. I used to really love going to Electroworks, which is next to Angel Tube. It's an old warehouse with a tube carriage in it. It's still going strong, I think, but definitely without me. I also really loved the Coronet, which sadly is not going strong. That was an old cinema at the Elephant, so demolished as part of the redevelopment of Elephant and Castle shopping centre. And then I guess lastly, this is sort of more gigs than raving, but very close to my heart is Brixton Academy, which was sadly the site of two deaths following crowd crushes a couple of years ago, but has recently reopened. Hopefully those sort of security concerns ironed out. But it was also, like the Coronet, originally a cinema. So I think there's something really fascinating about those London venues, that their history is not just a history of raving and partying. It also tells you something about the history of the area prior to that. And in Brixton's case, it tells you something about its kind of emergence as an affluent suburb.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that you mentioned the example of Brixton Academy, which certainly has been covered heavily in the media and on social media. A reminder how much these venues, when they are threatened with closure, it really echoes through communities of both past and present attendees. We know that gentrification lost revenue from successive lockdowns, rocketing rents, things like this have all contributed to the struggle of many venues. Simon, what is the value of these places, and why are they so much worth protecting in the first place?
I think with so much of London and so much of the rest of the country being filled with these sort of identikit chain bars, pubs, clubs, restaurants, these kind of independent venues with their own rich countercultural histories are a part of what gives London or any place its identity. It's what makes it that place rather than some other place. So I think they're absolutely worth protecting, and they're really critical to a sense of place, I think. And it would even if I guess as Dan Hancock says, even if I'm not personally filling the dance floor anymore, I think I would really feel the loss of these places deeply. It would change what it is to be a Londoner, I think, were they all to disappear.
We're now moving on to the culture section, and we're going to hear about Open House Festival 2024 from Simon. So you're deep in preparation for the big festival in September. For those listeners who haven't been to Open House Festival before, could you tell us a bit about the event and what it is having to offer them?
Well, it's a London-wide festival that opens up and celebrates the city's architecture and neighbourhoods, with free open days and events taking place across all 33 London boroughs. All 32 boroughs and the city, for any pedants out there. This year, the festival will take place from Saturday 14th to Sunday 22nd of September. Our mission is to provide access to spaces that wouldn't otherwise be open, to create opportunities for learning from and about the built environment and one another, and to create a stronger sense of connection, well-being and belonging. We really want to celebrate London and the communities that make it.
Fantastic. And what are some of the buildings you've had in the festival in previous years? I mean, obviously, that's like the big draw. And what type of buildings are you hoping to open for this year's festival, which I'm sure will be the best ever?
It always is the best ever. So some of the kind of obvious big names from last year were the BT Tower.
That's in the news lately.
Yeah, that's Downing Street. So some real kind of big hitters, some real celebrated pieces of public housing like Alexandra Road by Neve Brown. But in terms of my personal highlights from the last couple of years, one was Winscombe Street, which is another Neve Brown project, which was a short street of houses that he built for his family and some other families to live in. And you could see how it was a real kind of prototype for the work he went on to do for Camden. I really loved going to Phoenix Gardens in Soho, this kind of amazing community garden with still relatively or very new building there that has really kind of helped to kind of make that a genuine community space. It was amazing to see how well used it is. Really amazing to go and see that. I loved the Marshall Building at the LSE. I went to a herb garret above an old operating theatre that was part of the original St Thomas's Hospital. I went to a jazz performance at South Norwood Library. And I also went to Central Hill Estate, which is one of my favourite public housing projects in London. So there's a real kind of broad range, private homes, infrastructure projects, public buildings, Downing Street, community spaces. And those, I mean, it's when we say type, you know, what types of buildings do we want in the festival? The honest answer is we want the full breadth of buildings that people spend their time in London. We really, really do want it to be a festival that reflects and says something about London. It's all in all its sort of multiplicity, its complexity. And so it really does need, yeah, Londoners from all walks of life to get involved.
Fantastic. I mean, it's such a big range of places. And I imagine many people were thinking, having heard your call, how do you take part in that festival? Like, do you have to own the building? Could you put in a rented apartment, like social housing, for example, into the festival? Or could you even like nominate another building that you'd like to see inside? Like that thing that fascinates me. How do people go about putting stuff forward?
So you certainly don't need to own the building. All you need to do is have access, legal access to the building to be able to let people in. We absolutely do want to see more rented homes. If we only have certain types of homes, then we can only tell a partial story about London. We want to see the full range of homes that that Londoners inhabit. So yes, if you rent your home and you'd like to apply for the festival, please do. I'd really encourage you to go ahead. But yeah, the key thing is about having access to the building. Is it somewhere you work, somewhere you volunteer at, someone, maybe you know someone who lives there? Can you broker access? That kind of thing. People do very frequently nominate buildings they would like to get into. We often try our best, but what's much more helpful for us is if someone comes to us with a contact or with a way in, then we're much more likely to be able to make that happen rather than just sort of saying, that big building over there, I'd like that. So if you are inspired to apply for the festival, we're now open for applications. All you need to do is go to open-city.org.uk. You'll see there's a menu at the top of the screen and select Open House Festival go to Open House Festival 2024. You'll see full guidance on how to apply. You'll see all the dates. The final deadline for getting your applications in is 1st of July. So you've got plenty of time, but I do suggest you start now.
Simon, it's been an immense pleasure to feature you on The Brief this week. Hopefully you can join us again soon in the future. I think that would be fantastic. Where should listeners go to stay up to speed on the things you're doing? Obviously, you mentioned a link to the website. Are there social media handles somewhere else where they can follow your writing or other activities?
So I'm actually off social media these days, which I would recommend to anyone who's not tried it. So just go to the Open City website, apply to take part in the festival, and that would make me very happy indeed.
You've been listening to The Brief from Open City, made in association with the London Society and the 20th Century Society. This show is made possible in part thanks to Bloomberg Connects, a free digital guide to art and cultural organisations around the world. A link to download Bloomberg Connects is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed The Brief and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which covers all these issues and many more. To get early ad-free access to The Brief and support Open City's wider work, empowering young people from underrepresented communities, please become an Open City friend today. The link is in the show notes. The Brief is produced by Poppy Waring and hosted by Phineas Harper, Merlin Fulcher, Cyber Chatter, and Fran Williams. The series editor is Merlin Fulcher. Our theme music is by Chris Zabriskie. Open City is dedicated to making cities everywhere more open, accessible, and equitable.